This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
How do you tell Russia and China to stop their campaigns of political repression when we so openly endorse the grandiose scale of Sisi's?
That's Chris Murphy, chairman of the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Middle East Subcommittee, saying the White House is withholding enough aid to pressure Egypt's leaders to improve the country's human rights record. Details coming up. Also, West African leaders meet tomorrow to respond to the coup in Guinea. All these and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. The United States will withhold $130 million in annual military aid to Egypt to pressure the Egyptian government to improve its human rights record. However, 14 human rights groups described the decision as a blow to President Joe Biden's commitment to human rights. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi has the details.
The U.S. State Department has notified Congress that Secretary of State Antony Blinken will not certify that Egypt is making significant progress on human rights. On Tuesday, the State Department said the U.S. would put a hold on $130 million in military aid until the Egyptian government acts to improve its human rights record. However, nearly $170 million in military funds will be released to Cairo. The United States annually gives Egypt about $1.3 billion in military aid. However, Congress has passed a law requiring the government to withhold $300 million unless Egypt's human rights performance improves. Senate Relations Middle East Subcommittee Chairman Chris Murphy, Democrat from Connecticut, called the administration's move a big missed opportunity to stand up strongly and unequivocally for human rights. In July, Murphy told Congress that Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi has jailed as many as 60,000 of his political opponents and warned it would damage the United States' reputation if it provided the aid to Egypt.
When the whole world watches America deliver this giant blank check each year to Egypt while Sisi engages in this repeated brazen violation of human rights. How do you tell Russia and China to stop their campaigns of political repression when we so openly endorse the grandiose scale of Sisi's?
The State Department's recent human rights report included a variety of Egyptian rights violations, including extrajudicial killings, forced disappearances, torture, arbitrary detention, politically motivated reprisal, and restrictions on free expression, the press, and the internet. 14 human rights groups described the aid decision as a terrible blow to the Biden administration's stated commitment to human rights and to the rule of law. They also said that by releasing $170 million in military aid, President Joe Biden's administration sidesteps the intent of Congress. Sarah Lee Whitson, executive director of Democracy for the Arab World Now, accused the administration of supporting autocratic regimes in the Arab world, including the Egyptian president.
There has been no serious reexamination of the claimed American interests that serve to justify our continued support for unelected, unaccountable, authoritarian, and apartheid governments in the region. Egypt is but one example, notwithstanding President Biden's promise to end the blank check for Egypt. Apparently, President Sisi is still our favorite dictator.
The rights groups called on Congress to pressure Biden to withhold future military aid and to state that the administration's decision threatens the human rights of Egyptians and weakens the U.S. position on rights issues. Biden promised that U.S. foreign policy under his presidency would be centered on the defense of democracy and the protection of human rights. During the campaign, Biden criticized President Donald Trump's close relations with autocrats such as Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, whom Trump called his favorite dictator. But since taking office, the Biden administration has avoided taking actions that might disrupt the bilateral relations. News media on Tuesday quoted unnamed State Department officials saying the Biden administration has significant concerns about Egypt's human rights record, but that Egypt remains a partner on trade, regional security, and counter-terrorism efforts. Mohammed El-Shenawi, VOA News, Washington.
West African leaders will meet tomorrow on how to respond to the coup in Guinea and pressure the junta to return the country to constitutional rule. A Reuters report indicates that the 15-nation economic community of West African states, ECOWAS, has condemned the coup that ousted President Alpha Condé. It was the third coup in West and Central Africa since April. In Guinea's capital, Conakry, junta leader Mamadi Doumbouya has urged heads of political leaders to not repeat the errors of the past at the start of a week of discussions aimed at planning Guinea's future. The talks, which include political, business, and religious leaders, are expected to set the duration of the transition and who will lead it, as well as what political and institutional reforms are needed before elections. In South Africa, violence and even killings continue at gatherings of the ruling African National Congress ahead of local government elections scheduled for the 1st of November. ANC branches are meeting to decide which officials to nominate as candidates. If elected to high positions in towns and cities, these people stand to earn massive salaries and control tenders worth millions of dollars. As Darren Taylor reports, this has sparked intense and sometimes deadly intra-party rivalry.
Recently, armed men in a vehicle drove by an ANC meeting in KwaZulu-Natal province and opened fire, killing three women. Political analyst Ralph Matekha says such incidents show that the ruling party today is very different to the one crafted by Nelson Mandela. He says it resembles an organized crime syndicate rather than a political party.
The stakes are quite high. Members are desperate. The party is incapable of exerting discipline at the center. It's almost like a conglomeration of groups existing across the country, each vying for a small space while the national leadership of the party is observing, trying to find a way around the challenges. That's just where the ANC is.
The ANC has condemned the violence and says it remains dedicated to serving the interests of all citizens. But all around South Africa, services in towns and cities controlled by the ANC are deteriorating. Some of the party's municipalities have been plundered to the extent that they're bankrupt. Matekha is in no doubt that the ANC will lose a lot of votes in a lot of areas in a few weeks' time.
It doesn't look like there is any party that one can say has demonstrated a project that will justify outright majority in those metros. So most likely there will be coalitions in those areas. I just hope the coalitions work for the people.
Professor Setulego Matebisi of the University of Free State says ANC leaders are going to pay the price for allowing selfish, self-interested people into the party.
It's not about the interest of residents, but it's all about advancing and peddling certain individuals will ensure that certain people benefit. But it's all about power and access to resources.
He points out that while most of the ANC's traditional support is poor in terms of money, it's not poor-minded.
I think what will be a determining factor will be the voter turnout when many ANC disgruntled members decide not to exercise their democratic right, then I strongly believe the ANC will be in trouble in those municipalities.
Matebisi says the ANC leadership's move to send provincial officials to stamp out fires at problem branches will do more harm than good to the party.
They themselves are conflicted because they've also got personal interest in the candidates that will be elected at municipal level.
He says when ANC members take up arms against one another, it shows the party's bent on self-destruction.
The likelihood of a leader, whether it is at national, provincial, and even at municipal level, to lose his or her life over serving his own party, it's actually very high. And it is said it is coming from the ruling party.
Many analysts say the internal violence in the ANC caused by officials jockeying for position is also evidence that President Cyril Ramaphosa's so-called war on corruption in the party is stillborn. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
UN Deputy Secretary General Amina J. Mohammed recently visited Somalia to express the international community's support as the fragile Horn of Africa country gears up for the delayed presidential election. VOA's Ruben Chama reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
In our various meetings in the Somali capital, Mogadishu, Mohammed highlighted parliamentary elections that are underway as an opportunity to build on the progress made in women's political participation.
The focus has been on the elections and in particular women's participation and the 30% quota that has been promised. It's essential to have that and more if we can. Somalia has done well to get the 24%, but in the upper house and the lower house, we must see the 30%. Currently, it appears that we're moving to more than 24% in the upper house, but it's not guaranteed. And so what we were doing was speaking to all those who have something to do with this process.
The UN official emphasized that women's full inclusion in all sectors of society will contribute to the war-torn country's greater resilience, peace and stability.
Well, it's more than just a quota. It's also about women's economic empowerment. It's about their place in society and the growth of this nation that needs to be inclusive as we work towards peace. So the Women, Peace and Security agenda is very important. It's still about finding peace in Somalia in spite of the elections that will happen.
While urging timely, inclusive, peaceful and credible elections, the deputy UN chief expressed her solidarity with Somali women in demanding equal participation in the political process.
I think there is always a concern when two important parties have a rift, and in particular as we're going towards the elections. But I believe the discussions that we had with them today and those that they are having themselves look as though they will resolve those disputes and the elections will go ahead. We do impress upon them that it is important to resolve those as quickly as possible.
Somalia, a country already battered by decades of civil war and deadly attacks from Islamist insurgents linked to Al-Qaeda, is gearing up for a long-delayed presidential vote. The troubled country is currently holding elections for its upper house and is also preparing for elections for its lower house, known as the House of the People. The UN and other international partners have been heavily engaged in supporting national efforts to advance the poll, frequently voicing support for greater inclusion of women in the country's political arena. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
Witnesses say a suicide bomber walked into a tea shop made of corrugated tin and detonated an explosive vest in the Somali's capital yesterday, killing at least 11 people. The Al-Shabaab militant group claimed responsibility. The attack occurred near a checkpoint manned by government security forces in Wajir district, which is next to Mogadishu's airport and the headquarters of the African Union forces. Prime Minister Mohamed Hussein Roble condemned the barbaric act, saying it shows that Al-Shabaab is thirsty for the indiscriminate bloodshed of the Somali people. Last weekend, authorities in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe, detained two television journalists and ordered them to delete their footage of an event they were covering. The incident has raised questions about the state of media freedom as the country heads towards elections in 2023. Arigando has more on the story.
On Saturday, freelance journalists Pamina Stuso and Lulu Brenda Harris were briefly detained in order to delete footage they had recorded at the 22nd anniversary commemorations of the opposition movement for Democratic Change Alliance in Burnside, a suburb of Bulawayo. The two reporters were surrounded by security officers in civilian clothes as they filmed delegates streaming out of a meeting that had been ended by the police, effectively cutting short the address of the Alliance President Nelson Chamisa. Police said that the meeting, which was only attended by the party's provincial executives, was illegal, though the party maintains that they had adhered with COVID-19 regulations. One of the journalists, Paminas Tuso, told VOA that despite producing their accreditation cards, the security agents nevertheless insisted they destroy their work footage.
We tried to take footage of the people who were dispersing from the venue of the meeting. Then suddenly, two plainclothes security agents, and one of them claimed to be a military, approached us and asked us why we were taking some photos. We said, no, we were taking, this is a public place, we are allowed to take photos. Then he gave none of it and he impounded my camera and asked me to delete the footage which we had taken. I felt intimidated and I was not comfortable because we were dealing with the military according to what that person said. So it was really a scary moment for me as a journalist.
Meanwhile, the Media Institute of Southern Africa has strongly condemned alleged police action as heavy-handed. The group says accredited journalists are protected by Section 62 of the country's constitution, which guarantees press freedom and access to information. Tabani Moyo, the national director of the organization, speaks.
So deliberately, this is an assault to the constitution of Zimbabwe, which guarantees media freedom. And when you see members of the police and the military outrightly spelling out that they don't have time to respect what is provided for in the constitution, it becomes an issue of deliberate crackdown of the media and probably a pointer to what is going to happen, especially as the lockdown regulations are relaxed and political activities allowed to resume. It shows that we are treading on thin ice and that performance or exercise of journalism in Zimbabwe depends on the mood of the politics of the day.
Meanwhile, National Police spokesman Paul Nyati said he only read about the incident on social media and that there was no official report of the alleged incident when this reporter sought clarification on the reason for the order by police to delete the footage from journalist's equipment. Observers such as Tabani Moyo says the government should allow journalists to do their work unhindered by orders from state security that are illegal and that breach the country's constitution. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
While the COVID-19 pandemic has pushed Africa's economy into contraction, it has further highlighted the need for accelerating the continent's digitalization. Experts say countries can leverage rapid technological innovation to foster stronger economic growth and promote sustainability and inclusiveness against the backdrop of the urgent action needed to offset the impact of COVID-19 on Africa's economies and economic trajectory. Vera Songwe, the Executive Secretary of the United Nations Economic Commission for Africa, spoke with reporter Ruben Chama in the second part of their conversation.
Many African nations still struggle with generating enough electrical power to fuel growth. Is your institution, the Economic Commission for Africa, looking at ways in which green energy and digital technology can address that problem?
Of course, we still have 400 million Africans that live in the dark, and so it's a big and huge and important problem for those African individuals. But it's also an important problem for industry, because we cannot build industry on our continent. We cannot go to industrialization and or deliver prosperity if we do not deliver energy. So one of the things that we are doing at the Economic Commission for Africa is essentially working on the regulatory environment. We believe that if we can fix the regulatory environment, make it more attractive, we'll have a lot more investment that's coming. But beyond working on the regulatory environment, because we've been doing this for a long time and we will continue to do that for a long time, sometimes if you can attract concrete investments, it actually makes the case much faster. So today we are working with a couple of governments in South Africa, Senegal, Kenya, to see whether we can crowd in some private sector investment into green and renewable energy, also as a way of helping them meet their national determined contributions. As you know, we're preparing for COP26 on the way to Glasgow. And so we're working with many countries to see how their national determined contributions in the area of energy can be supported. We're working with one of the largest energy producers in the world, Enel, in Italy, to see how they can support African countries, particularly in solar and wind energy. What is the appropriate framework for public-private investment in that area.
Do you feel optimistic that there will be changes made for the new generation of women and young people in Africa, or are you worried about the continent's future?
Well, you have to be optimistic, I believe, to continue working on Africa's development, but I think it's a cautious optimism because we have to also continue to ensure that we know what we need to do. I think the good thing about the continent is that, you know, a lot of our challenges have been diagnosed and solutions have been provided. I think where we hit a lot more difficulties in the implementation phase, and we do need to begin to move to a continent that is much more resource-driven. And I think once we get into that kind of a mindset, of course, difficult to not talk about, you know, the challenges we're still facing on the governance front, and the need to be able to work to improve on some of our governance challenges, because that is also part of the reason why our implementation sometimes lags behind, you know, our aspirations and ambitions. So, yes, a lot of optimism, but still, a need to continue to remain vigilant, a need to continue, I think, to sort of make sure that people are aware of the gaps and the need to see whether those can be improved and improved much faster than we're doing now.
That was Vira Songwi, the Executive Secretary of the United Nations Economic Commission for Africa, speaking with VOA's Ruben Chama from Nairobi. International aid groups are calling on Burkina Faso's government to let them help register the country's internally displaced people. The Norwegian Refugee Council says the government is taking weeks to register IDPs for food and other aid, forcing some back into dangerous areas. Henry Wilkins reports from Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso.
In a statement released Monday, the Norwegian Refugee Council, NRC, said government authorities are taking weeks to register IDPs, like these 500 or so, who until recently stayed at a school in the town of Ouagadougou. The NRC say they could carry out the registration process, which is essential before aid can be distributed to IDPs within a week, and implored the government to, quote, let us step in and support. Rasmata Ouedraogo, who was living in the school, fled her village of Nongo with her son after a terrorist attack. She says they were wearing army uniforms, so it was difficult to know if they were terrorists. She had to hide herself for 2 days in her house. She says she arrived in Ouagadougou around 2 months ago, and so far her family has received $100 in aid payments. The first thing we need is food for us and our children, and then some clothes, among other things, she told VOA. The community leader of the IDP says this month students will return to their studies, so the school's owner has asked the IDPs to move out. Local authorities sent them to a site outside of the town where access to food and services is difficult. At the very beginning, we were able to have some cereal like maize and millet, plus $100 for each family. But that was 2 to 3 months ago, he says. He added that some people arrived more recently, and those people have not gotten any food so far. Many of the IDPs who stayed at the school say they are unsure of whether they've been registered or not, but say none of them are receiving enough aid. Tom Peire Costa is from the Norwegian Refugee Council.
But authorities really lack the capacity to count and register newly displaced people. And meanwhile, aid organizations are not allowed to intervene. So this is what we are asking for today. We need more flexibility.
In a tense press conference Monday, Lawrence Marshall Ilbudo, the Minister of Humanitarian Affairs, said this when asked why offers of assistance from aid groups were being turned down. You asked why we don't make it easier for the partners if they can do it better than the locals. But why them? Because they have the resources? Because they have the machines? Our nation has the expertise to do it. Why don't we make use of this material expertise so that the locals can do it themselves? As the school now lies empty, waiting for the students to return, the IDPs who resided there remain in need of help. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.